When Maury was a teenager, his father took him to a fur factory where he worked. This was during the Depression, and the idea was to get Maury a job. He entered the factory and immediately felt as if the walls had closed in around him. The room was dark and hot, the windows covered with filth, and the machines were packed tightly together, churning like train wheels. The fur hairs were flying, creating a thickened air, and the workers, sewing their pelts together, were bent over their needles as the boss marched up and down the rows, screaming for them to go faster, faster. Maury could hardly breathe. He stood there next to his father, frozen with fear, hoping the boss wouldn't scream at him, too. During lunch break, his father took Maury to the boss and pushed him in front of him, asking if there was any work for his son. But there was barely enough work for the adult laborers, and no one was giving it up. For Maury, this was a blessing. He hated the place. He made another vow that he kept to the end of his life. He would never do any work that exploited someone else, and he would never allow himself to make money off the sweat of others. "What will you do?" Ava would ask him. "I don't know," he would say. He ruled out law because he didn't like lawyers, and he ruled out medicine because he couldn't take the sight of blood. "What will you do?" It was only through default that the best professor I ever had became a teacher. A teacher affects eternity. He can never tell where his influence stops. Henry Adams. The fourth Tuesday, we talk about death. "Let's begin with this idea," Maury said. "Everyone knows they're going to die, but nobody believes it." He was in a business-like mood this Tuesday. The subject was death, the first item on my list. Before I arrived, Maury had scribbled a few notes on small white pieces of paper so that he wouldn't forget. His shaky handwriting was now indecipherable to everyone but him. It was almost Labor Day, and through the office window I could see the spinach-colored hedges of the backyard and hear the yells of children playing down the street, their last week of freedom before school began. Back in Detroit, the newspaper strikers were gearing up for a huge holiday demonstration to show the solidarity of unions against management. On the plane ride in, I had read about a woman who had shot her husband and two daughters as they lay sleeping, claiming she was protecting them from, quote, the bad people. In California, the lawyers in the O.J. Simpson trial were becoming huge celebrities. Here in Maury's office, life went on one precious day at a time. Now we sat together a few feet from the newest addition to the house, an oxygen machine. It was small and portable, about knee-high. On some nights, when he couldn't get enough air to swallow, Maury attached the long plastic tubing to his nose, clamping on his nostrils like a leech. I hated the idea of Maury connected to a machine of any kind, and I tried not to look at it as Maury spoke. "Everyone knows they're going to die," he said again, "but nobody believes it. If we did, we would do things differently." "So, we kid ourselves about death?" I said. "Yes," he said, "but there's a better approach. To know you're going to die, and to be prepared for it at any time. That's better. That way you can actually be more involved in your life while you're living." "How can you ever be prepared to die?" I asked. Maury said, "Do what the Buddhists do. Every day have a little bird on your shoulder that asks, 'Is today the day? Am I ready? Am I doing all I need to do? Am I being the person I want to be?'" Maury turned his head to his shoulder as if the bird were there now. "Is today the day I die?" he said. Maury borrowed freely from all religions. He was born Jewish but became agnostic when he was a teenager, partly because of all that had happened to him as a child. He enjoyed some of the philosophies of Buddhism and Christianity, and he still felt at home culturally in Judaism. He was a religious mutt, which made him even more open to the students he taught over the years, and the things he was saying in his final months on earth seemed to transcend all religious differences. Death has a way of doing that. "The truth is, Mitch," he said, "once you learn how to die, you learn how to live." I nodded. "I'm going to say it again," he said. "Once you learn how to die, you learn how to live." He smiled, and I realized what he was doing. He was making sure I absorbed this point without embarrassing me by asking. It was part of what made him a good teacher. "Did you think much about death before you got sick?" I asked. "No." Maury smiled. "I was like everyone else. I once told a friend of mine in a moment of exuberance, 'I'm going to be the healthiest old man you ever met.'" "How old were you?" I asked. "In my 60s. "So you were optimistic." "Why not?" he said. "Like I told you, no one really believes they're going to die." "But everyone knows someone who has died," I said. "Why is it so hard to think about dying?" "Because," Maury continued, "most of us walk around as if we're sleepwalking. We really don't experience the world fully because we're half asleep doing things we automatically think we have to do." "And facing death changes all that?" I asked. "Oh, yes," Maury said. "You strip away all that stuff and you focus on the essentials. When you realize you're going to die, you see everything much differently. He sighed. Learn how to die, and you learn how to live. I noticed that he quivered now when he moved his hands. His glasses hung around his neck, and when he lifted them to his eyes, they slid around his temples, as if he were trying to put them on someone else in the dark. I reached over to help guide them onto his ears. Thank you, Maury whispered. He smiled when my hand brushed up against his head. The slightest human contact was immediate joy. Mitch, can I tell you something? Of course, I said. You might not like it. Why not? Well, the truth is, if you really listen to that bird on your shoulder, if you accept that you can die at any time, then you might not be as ambitious as you are. I forced a small grin. The things you spend so much time on, Maury said, all this work you do, it might not seem so important. You might have to make room for some more spiritual things. Spiritual things, I said. You hate that word, don't you, Maury said. Spiritual. You think it's touchy-feely stuff. Well, I said. He tried to wink, a bad try, and I broke down and laughed. Mitch, he continued, laughing along. Even I don't know what spiritual development really means, but I do know we're deficient in some way. We're too involved in materialistic things, and they don't satisfy us. The loving relationships we have, the universe around us, we take these things for granted. He nodded toward the window with the sunshine streaming in. You see that? You can go out there, outside, any time. You can run up and down the block and go crazy. I can't do that. I can't go out. I can't run. I can't be out there without fear of getting sick. But you know what? I appreciate that window more than you do. Appreciate it, I said. Yes, I look out that window every day. I notice the change in the trees, how strong the wind is blowing. It's as if I can see time actually passing through that window. Because I know my time is almost done, I'm drawn to nature as if I'm seeing it for the first time. He stopped, and for a moment we both just looked out that window. I tried to see what he saw. I tried to see time and seasons, my life passing in slow motion. Maury dropped his head slightly and curled it towards his shoulder. Is it today, little bird? He asked. Is it today?